from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our next hour, I'll talk with the authors of All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans. The book addresses fiction such as Thanksgiving proves the Indians welcomed pilgrims and Indians are naturally predisposed to alcoholism. We'll discuss misconceptions about Native Americans and the surge of activism around the Dakota Access Pipeline. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this hour of the Forum program. Last week, 2,000 protesters of the Dakota Access Pipeline shared a Thanksgiving feast at the Standing Rock Indian Reservation in North Dakota. And as those protesters draw worldwide attention to Native American rights and issues, we're joined by the authors of All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans. San Francisco-based author and professor emerita of Native American Studies at Cal State East Bay, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, received the 2015 American Book Award for an Indigenous People's History of the United States. And Dina Gilio-Whitaker is co-author of All the Real Indians Died Off and associate scholar and researcher at the Center for World Indigenous Studies. And we welcome them both to this Forum Hour. And let me first of all welcome you, Roxanne, who's here in studio with us, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz.
Thank you, Michael.
An official welcome to Dina Gilio-Whitaker, who joins us by phone this morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Actually, Dina, I want to begin with you. We're going to talk about your book, obviously, and myths that you get into here. And one of the things that's said early on is just how, I hate to put it so bluntly, but about how ignorant most Americans are about Indians. I mean, they don't necessarily know more than a couple of tribes, or they don't know who Leonard Peltier was, and so it goes. And certainly the myths that you expose have a great deal to do with that lack of understanding of Native American history or Native American culture. But there are a lot of tribes together up now in North Dakota, and a lot of young people have joined the demonstrations. And I know you were just there, and so I want to get sort of a report from you on what you saw.
Yeah, I just got back late last night. It was a pretty amazing experience. You know, we're hearing that from, you know, everybody who goes there, and everybody has their own experience of what it was like to be there. And it was intense on so many levels. I mean, just going out there was this epic journey. It took us, what should have been a 22-hour drive, took us 36 hours because we got stranded in a road closure on Thanksgiving Day in Wyoming and slept in the car with the car running for 12 hours so we didn't freeze to death. And so when we got there, we were part of a major influx of people. People were pouring into the camp nonstop. You know, it was the weekend. People have extra time, and I think they've heard the call, and they took advantage of the opportunity to go out there. And so, so it was just this incredible swelling of the population of Ocheche Shakoin, which is where I was. So, you know, there's different camps, and there's, you know, two kind of main areas. There's the Ocheche Shakoin main camp that consists of the camps of many different nations and groups, including the Red Warrior camp. And then there's the Sacred Stone camp, which is in a different area that I never even got to. But when I was there, the population had grown, probably doubled at least, and there were estimates of maybe upwards of 13,000 people.
Yeah, there's an amazing number of people there, and it actually prompts me to sort of make a link to the book that you both have put together here, because there's a lot in the book about appropriation, cultural appropriation. And Roxanne, I'm looking at an article here from Dazed, which says people are treating the protests like Burning Man, standing. Rock has reportedly been overrun with white demonstrators trying to soak up the cultural experience, and actually, they're using language here about colonizing the camp, saying, in effect, that these protesters are even appearing to live off Native Americans who are providing them with food. There's a sense, in other words, of the protesters, soaking up the cultural experience as if it were something like a rainbow gathering or Burning Man.
Well, you know, I read that, too. I read it on Facebook. It certainly has gotten around. Of all the thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of comments, including on my Facebook page and Dina's, with, you know, analysis of the whole situation, there's this sort of one experience that gets blown up into the general experience. I'm sure some of that's happening, but I have confidence, and Dina can say she was, you know, there seeing things, but I have confidence that Native people are taking care of the situation. They know how, they've lived a long time around white people, and appropriation's the least of the crimes committed against Native people. So I think that they are able to handle it, that they're always in any gathering like this, like the Occupy movement in 2011, they're going to be people who have lack social skills or are on drugs or simply, you know, mentally ill or bad people, and also people who are planted as provocateurs by the various security forces.
Well, let me go back to you on this, Dina. I mean, I don't know what you observed there, but the reality is, I suppose, that many of these white kids who are there maybe with the spirit of Burning Man or something are also being exposed to Native culture in ways that they never had before, and understanding, you know, what sacred land is all about, what water rights are about. I presume there's a lot of that, too, isn't there? Education going on?
Yeah, absolutely. And to be fair, I think Roxanne's assessment of it is pretty right on. And I think that the way that I'm thinking about it as I process my experience is that, and there were, you know, by far more non-Native people in the camp now than Native people, but to be in that space is really, it's to be Indigenous sovereign space. And it's what this means is that for non-Native people in that space, it's a steep learning curve, unless they're people who have, you know, who have been in, you know, maybe gone to powwows or been on reservations or even been in Native ceremonial contexts like Sundance or sweat lodges or whatever, which, you know, some of those kind of rainbow people have. But this is really different. I mean, what's going on there, yes, there is sort of a festival vibe that happens. It's a little disconcerting, a little upsetting. But this learning curve is about non-Native people coming into Native-controlled spaces and in this case, very, very politicized. Yeah, there's ceremony going on there. It is, as they say, you know, it's a ceremonial space, but it's a politicized ceremonial space that has the undercurrent of a sovereignty narrative. And so these people have to learn to be in that space. There are protocols. You don't come into, it's like going to somebody else's country, you know, going to France or going to Germany or somewhere, any pick a country, and, you know, bringing all your American values and, you know, like that, kind of like that ugly American thing, you know, people lack a sensitivity like Americans. But these people coming into Standing Rock, I think they're different. They want to be different. They want to learn. And they, you know, it's a painful learning process. It's this learning curve. And so, you know, learning how to be in that space, even for Native people, I mean, for me, myself, as a Native person coming into Lakota space, is not like me going home to the Colville Reservation. It's very similar. There are similar ways of being, But I have to be, I have to walk carefully too. There are ways that you be around a fire that are appropriate and not appropriate. There are just, you know, subtle ways of being that if you don't know, you don't know. And so it requires like an extra sensitivity and awareness. And sometimes people have to be guided, they have to be told, and sometimes it can hurt.
Well, maybe they have to be told also about appropriation, which you spend some time on in your book, talking about, for example, Halloween costumes and colorful spiritual ceremonies and all this New Age stuff that ties itself to what are Native customs and Native traditions, and maybe in some ways co-opts them or usurps them. But there are things I know that are probably way in with far more gravity and concern that come up in the book, and a lot of those have to do with stereotypes, you know, the drunken and lazy Indian, or the idea of that we have. And let me go to you on this, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, who's here with us in studio. The idea of, you know, Indians getting rich off casinos, all of these kinds of things, which really are baleful. I mean, there's no other way to describe them.
Some are even contradictory, like those two. Indians are getting rich off casinos. They're all rich, or they're all on welfare. You know, it's both things. But underneath that is the resentment for Native people who aren't poor. They're supposed to that's their category. They're supposed to be poor and deprived. So when they are doing well, they're building housing and infrastructure. When they have a casino, that's just, they're not Indians anymore because they're doing well. So that's the part of the colonial mythology of the disappearing Native person, the ways in which to characterize the Native person as a historic relic and not real functioning people and nations and communities today.
This is one of the main arguments of your book, that they're disappearing Indians from plain sight. You call it structural violence, and Native peoples are, in effect, becoming more and more invisible.
Yes, right now, especially. This is a window of opportunity. It's also, it should be mentioned, there are resistance movements going on all over North America all the time, including Canada, because they're really the leaders in the fighting, you know, climate change has affect them a lot in the Arctic area, Native people in Alaska and the Yukon and in the northwest of what is now Canada. But all over, if you, as we do a lot, Dina and I travel around the country and meet with different Native people a lot, we're told about these things, but they never get into the press. This didn't even get into the press in April when it started, and when the resistance started.
Maybe it got in part because it was such a big environmental issue, and that's what's drawn a lot of these young white kids, too.
It's true, you know, that. But all of these are also environmental issues. I think the extraordinary thing about this time is it's almost always out front are the kind of gatekeepers of the mainstream indigenous movement, environmental movement. And now and then they'll bring a Native person on to speak. But this time it's under the leadership of Native people, even the official tribal council. And this is highly unusual and I think very important and positive.
Talking to Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz and Dina Gilio Whitaker, who are co-authors of All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans. And when I think about these myths, Dina Gilio Whitaker, I think about, a couple things come rapidly to mind. One, the idea of these savages who were civilized and, you know, you can see it in a lot of early American literature, go out in the woods with hawthorn, you know, and that's where all of this primal activity takes place and transgressive behavior that was seen because they were heretics in the minds of many of those who colonized. But also, film is a major source of this misunderstanding of Native American history, which almost screams out for a need for a counter-narrative based on truth. And I'm talking about the fact that not so much as you guys write about in your book, Brando's revolt against the way Natives were portrayed in movies, but even going up to things like that are sentimentalizing, like Kevin Costner Dances with Wolves or The Last of the Mohicans.
Well, yeah, and that's, you know, it's about the narrative of the Indian as savage, and there's two aspects of that. There's the noble, the ignoble savage, and the noble savage.
Yeah.
Either way, Indians are savage, and it's that savagery that legitimizes and justifies the need to exterminate them. And so, you know, and that leads to the other subject that we tackle in the book on genocide. You know, we live in a country that was built on genocide, the twin evils of genocide and slavery. And the genocide was made possible because of the construction of Indian people as other, as the savage other. And in order to keep legitimizing that erasure, that disappearance, the society needs to keep perpetuating that, and that's why we talk about, you know, in the theory of settler colonialism, that's what settler colonialism does, is it continually reproduces that those actions, those realities in a structure that never ends. So it's more than just, you know, a historic event that we can just move past and just say, oh, it was a tragic history. Now we all have to move on and be okay with it. And
can we talk about genocide, though? Because it really is a very, to put it mildly, a very explosive and radioactive word. And there are those who argue, and maybe Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, I'll go to you on this, those who have argued, I've had historians on this program argue, yes, it was terrible and unconscionable and appalling what was done to Native Americans, indigenous people, but there were way more deaths due to smallpox. And some of that smallpox, if you read people like Paul Muldoon, were put there by the Americans on blankets and so forth and so on, or by the Canadians. But the reality is that many deaths were because of you know, disease. That were often attributed to the high numbers in genocide. How do you separate those?
Well, it's I think it's very simple, but it gets confused because the way in which the concept of genocide is, I think, tossed around as meaning extreme extermination. That is just shooting people, putting them in gas ovens. The Holocaust was the basis for forming the Genocide Convention of 1948, but that convention is a prevention and is the prevention of genocide as well as a punishment of genocide, and it has a number of factors. It's saying that, for instance, the Holocaust, if you look back, it goes back, I think Eli Wiesel said it goes back to the Crusades, a straight line, all the pogroms in Christian Europe. These were all evidence of a potential Holocaust which happened. So to prevent that, we look at what is happening, such as this denial of sovereignty and the treaty rights of the Sioux people right now. That is one of the aspects of genocide, one of the main causes of genocide in the Genocide Convention is the creation of conditions by government policy that make the future of a group's existence impossible. So I think that's
you're speaking, of course, about the possibility of water being deadly and lethal.
Having no water, having no, and that can be expanded to a lot of things.
I was thinking not so much of no water, which I think is part of the equation too, but just the water being so contaminated
exactly.
by oil. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think we have to break down genocide also and look at, you know, the Genocide Convention, which is only in effect in 1948 and in the United States only in 1988 because of the fear of being accused of genocide for slavery and for Native genocide. The United States wouldn't ratify the Genocide Convention, which was already considered international common law by the time they did. But there are things happening right now that are actually genocide. It's not just historical. But historically, you can go through different periods of time and break it down like Benjamin Madley has done with California.
And again, we're talking to the co-authors of All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, who is here with us in studio, and Dina Gilio-Whitaker, who is with us by phone this morning. And let's look at some of these myths. One of the big ones, from your perspective, sports mascots honor Native Americans. Boy, that's been an ongoing controversial subject. Dina Gilio-Whitaker, that's what people like Dan Snyder, the Washington Redskins, says. You know, this is honoring my own home team, Cleveland Indians. They've said for years this honors the Native American. It's a myth. Why is it a myth?
Well, because for the most part, most Native people don't feel that they're being honored. I mean, these guys have used a narrative of, you know, they go out and they handpick a few Indian people here or there, or people who claim to be Indian, and say that, you know, well, we don't feel offended by it, so it's okay. And they glom onto that, and they highlight it and use that as a justification to keep perpetuating these, you know, these ridiculous cartoon images of people. I mean, that Cleveland Indians one is so especially
it's offensive. Egregious. Yeah, it's offensive.
Yeah, it's like you could never, you know, get away with that if that was, you know, a team like the Africans, you know, the African fighting Africans, or, you know, the fighting Jews, or whatever. I mean, it's, you know, we all know that you could never get away with that, that caricaturizing, that that objectifying of other people who have been oppressed. But it's, you know, this thing that it's okay to do that to Indians, even in this day and age, that it's mind-boggling, it's baffling that people can actually tell you that with a straight face and expect that you're going to be okay with it and believe it.
Now, let me look at a couple other myths with you. We're coming up on a break here, and I want to go to Roxanne on this because they're tied in. We just celebrated Thanksgiving, and Thanksgiving proves the Indians welcome pilgrims. Doesn't exactly square with history, nor does the fact perhaps that Columbus actually discovered America.
Yes, and that's mascotry. We started calling the sports emblems, the military equipment, automobiles, all of this naming. Thanksgiving also in the 20th century got created as mascotry of dressing up like pilgrims and Indians. And so it's just another example of that disappearing of Native people. But it really is a kind of calendar. You might say a calendar of genocide that starts with Columbus, the doctrine of discovery, literally the disappearance of people by fiat.
Roxanne, forgive me. We're coming up on a break, and I want to give listeners an opportunity to join us and tell them how they can do that before we return. Again, we're talking to the co-authors of All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans. You can join us now, and we welcome your calls and emails. Our toll-free number for your calls is 866-733-6786. Questions and comments welcome. Again, that's 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQED Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We have the co-authors of a new book, which dispels a lot of common myths about Native Americans. And last week, 2,000 protesters of the Dakota Access Pipeline shared a Thanksgiving feast at the Standing Rock Indian Reservation in North Dakota. And all those protesters draw worldwide attention to Native American rights and issues. We're talking with the authors of All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans, and they address fictions such as Thanksgiving proves the Indians welcome pilgrims, or Indians are naturally predisposed to alcohol. And we're discussing misconceptions about Native Americans and the surge of activism around the Dakota Access Pipeline. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz with us in studio is co-author of that book and also professor emerita of Native American Studies at Cal State University in the East Bay, and building up my library with a couple of her other books here. She just handed to me An Indigenous People's History of the United States, which won the American Book Award, And, excuse me, The Great Sioux Nation, Sitting in Judgment of America, also by Roxanne. Dina Gilio-Whitaker, also with us, co-author of All the Real Indians Died Off and a journalist in India Country Today Media Network, associate scholar at the Center for World Indigenous Studies. And we do welcome your involvement in this whole discussion that we're having, a conversation about Indians and myths and also about the protests going on in North Dakota. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also communicate with us on Facebook or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at @KQEDForum. Roxanne had some thoughts that I wanted to at least have you continue to follow through on here. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz is with us in studio. Just about the changing of history, it's a pretty clear line. I mean, but it goes back and it has a continuity to it.
Yeah, and if you follow the calendar that we celebrate these phases of history, we start with Columbus in the fall. Columbus never touched on the North American continent. So why are so many things named after Columbus? It's sort of honoring the papal doctrine of discovery that when...
Should it be called Indigenous Peoples Day, as they do in Berkeley, rather than Columbus Day?
Yes, this is, in fact, Berkeley, of course, is the oldest, but there's cities and towns and campuses around the country that have turned it into, like North Dakota calls it Native American Day. Other cities, Berkeley, campuses say Indigenous Peoples Day, and I think that will happen one of these days. But I think it's still important to deal with why there's this affinity for Columbus, and then we have Thanksgiving, which is kind of the origin story of the United States, or the second step of the origin story after discovery and claiming, is actually taking. Some people call it taking giving instead of or thanks taking rather than giving. And then you have in February, you have the honoring of the founding fathers and, of course, Lincoln. And we have one of our myths is about the presidents and their supposed benevolence toward Native people, which is not the case. And then it all goes up in fireworks on July 4th, the Declaration of Independence, and a whole new colonial regime is established. So
we're talking about history and counter-history, really, aren't we?
Yes, and we're talking about celebrating genocide and celebrating slavery, for that matter, because Columbus was the beginning of the transatlantic slave trade as well.
You know, we have a lot of callers and a lot of emailers. I want to get to as many of you as I can. But one other thing I wanted to hear. Well, let me go to you on this, Dina Gilio-Whitaker, because Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz and I were talking a bit about it before we went on the air. That is this strange, almost obsessive need of many Americans to fractionalize Indians and talk about, or Native Americans and talk about, well, what, you know, because both of you have Native roots, but there seems to be this notion that there's a fractionalization. You're half Indian, you're a quarter Indian, you know, those kind of questions that often are heard, even by people who have established a very significant Native American identity. I'm thinking about people, of course, like Leslie Marmon Silko or Sherman Alexie and Louise Erdrich. People will say, well, they're half Indian or they're part Indian. Yeah. And they don't say that about African-Americans. They say they're black.
Right, exactly. And the best way to understand that is by comparing the two groups, Native Americans and blacks. Black people had what was called the one-drop rule, which was a way of policing racial boundaries in order to keep the races separate and thus maintain like this kind of ideology of racial purity, white racial purity. And also to keep the system of slavery going. So when slave women were raped, you know, which often happened, they had children. The condition of the children followed the mother, which meant that, you know, half black, half white children would automatically be slaves. So the one-drop rules fall is that, where one drop of black blood makes you black, and that's to keep this system of segregation in place. For Indigenous peoples, on the other hand, the fractionation of blood, this parsing out of blood as in a calculus where blood equals culture, is all about separating Indians from their land. And so if you say that a real Indian only has X, you know, amount of blood quantum, that allows them basically to stay with their lands, to be considered Indian. And as Indian people intermarry with non-Indigenous populations and the blood quantum thins out, then it's a way to continually dispossess them of that identity and thus their connection to the land.
But so you got over 500 tribes in America and different tribal membership rules. I mean, tribes have to judge who belongs, and then the federal government has to step in and in many cases and judge. And that becomes a source of real confusion for many people. Go ahead, Dina. Sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, it does. I mean, there has been identified the scholar Eva Garut, in her book Real Indians, identified no less than 33 different and separate legal definitions for Native American. And so you can be Native American based on one definition of Native American, and then on another law or statute, you are not Native American. So it is very confusing.
And here's a caller right on point with this. Amy joins us as our first caller up. Amy, you're on. Welcome.
Hi, Roxanne, and hi, Dina. This is Amy Lemmer from Sonoma County. And I'm
Hi, Amy.
Hi, and I'm Choctaw by Nation and on my father's side. And the thing that I wanted to talk about a little bit was one of the issues that I have as a Native person is what to be called. When you say Indian, it's confusing because there's East Indians, and then if you say, Native American, then people say, well, I'm Native to America, and then are you talking about North America or South America? And I think it's part of what has me feel as a Native person as if I don't exist. Like, there's not even a good term for who I am. I've been so, my history has been so obscured. I like to use the word Indigenous because it seems...
I was just going to ask, what's wrong with Indigenous? Yeah.
The thing that I like most about Indigenous is that it encapsulates a sort of a worldview, which is spiritual and sees the earth not as a resource given to Christian men by God to extract things from, but as a, as an actual being that we are beholden to for our very lives and for everything that makes us human. And so I like the word Indigenous, but yet Indigenous is not, does not fully express what it is to be of the heritage of the people that were here on this continent before Europeans came here.
Yeah, Amy, I appreciate your call. And let me go to Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz on this. I mean, just calling Native people by a name that seems to fit is kind of a conundrum in many ways, isn't it?
It is. It's one of our myths. They can't even decide on what to be called.
They can't decide, right?
Right.
Amy, thank you for the call. And let me bring on more of our callers. Let me go next to Michael. Michael, you're on. Morning.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. Here is my question. Let us just take for fact what the authors are arguing, that there's systemic annihilation of Indians, genocide. The whole argument will accept it. The question I have is, aren't you in a fundamentally inconsistent position? On one hand, in some sense, you want to preserve Indian culture. But on the other hand, you want to protect the Indian. And I don't see how you do that unless the Indians become part of the political process in the United States. For example, they would need to be U.S. citizens, have the power to vote, have lobbyists. And as an example, I would compare Israel with Palestine. Israel has a lot of power and a lot of sway because there are interest groups in the United States with voting power and the ability to contribute to elections. So I don't see how you can save the Indian failed state because it's predicated on a separation from the United States. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Roxanne or Dina, who wants to step up here? Roxanne, you're on the verge of saying something. Go ahead.
Well, I there were a lot of presumptions in that question that that I didn't quite understand, but Native people do have lobbyists. They're Navajo lobbyists. They're National Congress, American Indian lobbyists. Native Americans vote. They've had the right to vote. Only since 1963, I think, the last state finally allowed Native people to vote. They were bestowed citizenship without asking for it in 1924. So Native people are completely interlocked with the U.S. System. It's a colonial system. It's sort of like the British Empire and its relationship with other kinds of countries that received independence because they did not have settler colonialism like India or Nigeria or Kenya and most of Africa. But in the case of settler colonialism, as in the United States, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia, the whole point was to replace, was to remove and replace the indigenous peoples. So you have an inherent genocide built into that policy and that goal. And outnumbering is certainly the case, even on many reservations, because they were allotted. There are more non-Indians than Indians in those reservation boundaries still today.
This analogy to colonialism, though, I think is very important to understand. Yeah. I mean, it's not even analogous. It's just a fact that although the word genocide can be misused and is too haphazardly used, in my judgment, there was a cultural genocide as well to Indians. I mean, the feeling was they had to be converted. They had to be, you know, this is white man's burden, take them and convert them to Christianity so their souls can be saved, but also get rid of their languages because their languages only held them down to be savages.
But, you know, built into the genocide treaty is a definition of genocide, is cultural genocide, because it only deals with groups and not individuals. So a group is defined by its language, its culture, its land base, its history. And if you take that away, if you take the culture away, you've literally destroyed the people. So that's one reason why Native people are so busy rebuilding their nations and reconstructing their cultures. They're actually know that if that goes, then they go. Even if they are individually still walking around, they're not connected.
And there are indigenous languages which, for all practical purposes, no longer exist, and therefore it's almost as if the people don't exist because their language is their peoplehood.
Yeah, that's a definition of the disappearance is the language, but it's a pretty amazing, like the Yuchi language of relocated people in Oklahoma who were forced on with the Cherokees and not given their own land base. And it was thought that they were Cherokee citizens, that their language was completely dead, their specific culture was completely dead. But it's been revived by an amazing young Yuchi who trained himself in linguistics. And
I love stories like that.
Yeah, I love the reconstruction of language stories.
Actually, speaking of language, we were talking before about just the name India or the name Indians. Excuse me. Rika says, I'm an Indian from India. I'd like to know why this misnomer for Native Americans is still being used actively, even on an acclaimed program such as yours. And that gets into, again, the whole myth of what's the name and what can you find that really covers the name and all. Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, the legal name that the federal government uses for Native Americans or indigenous peoples is American Indian. So we have to use it in many cases simply because that is in any court document or in documents we're quoting. There's no way to get around it.
But there were attempts, really, especially with the AIM, the American Indian Movement, to call it Amerindian, I remember, you know.
Yeah.
We're Native Americans or we're, you know, indigenous people and so forth. But yeah. Indian has stuck. It just stuck.
The scholar Vine Deloria, you know, he wrote in one of his books, he said that
Custer died for our sins, I think, is the book we're talking about here. Yeah.
So Vine Deloria said the problem is that, you know, America never knew how to deal with tribal names. There's over 500 of them. So if I say, to somebody that I'm Colville, most people have never even heard of the Colville Confederated Tribes. They would look at me and glaze over and say, what the heck are you talking about? And to complicate it even further, if I say within that lineage, my own lineage is St. Ikes, people really don't know what to do with it, especially since in Canada we were bifurcated by the border in Canada. Our people were above the border in Canada and are now on the Colville Reservation. And the Canadian government has declared St. Ikes people extinct. And they're fighting a court battle right now to have them recognized, because we all know we're still here.
You might do better with Trudeau at the helm. At least that's the feeling I get from Canadians. I'm looking at a comment from Ben who says, when I traveled to Alaska, I learned of the myriad of tribes and cultures that covered thousands of miles. Even the name Native American creates a myth of one unifying group, while in reality, there are so many different tribes and cultures. And here's Jordan who writes, hearing this discussion about product naming and mascotting reminds me of one of my favorite quotes from Noam Chomsky. Quote, we still name our military helicopter gunships after victims of genocide. Nobody bats an eyelash about that. Black Hawk, Apache, and Comanche. If the Luftwaffe named its military helicopters Jew and Gypsy, I suppose people would notice. End of quote from Chomsky. And some questions. And let me go to you, Nestina. Joe writes, I'd like to understand more about the treaty the Standing Rock protesters refer to and why the U.S. government does not honor it.
Well, Roxanne, I'm going to just defer to Roxanne because she is such the treaty expert on this. But
we'll defer to that expertise then. I thought since you were just up there. Go ahead, Roxanne.
Well, thank you, Dean. That's a challenge. Yeah, well, I did this book called The Great Sioux Nation, which is a oral history of the Sioux Treaty with the United States of 1868, the Fort Laramie Treaty. There was a previous treaty in 1851, also Fort Laramie Treaty, that's superseded by the Great Sioux Nation Treaty, because it actually is they won more concessions from the United States with the new treaty. That treaty and many, many others, not all Native nations have treaties, but those who do not have treaties, by U.S. legal definition, they have implied treaties, or else they don't exist. It's unceded land, and it means that those Native people never, like the Seminoles of Florida, never, ever signed a treaty with the United States, but they do have a very large and prosperous reservations. So the United States experts, congressmen, legal experts know very well that these are living, active treaties, and that when they're dealing with our work at the United Nations in the last 40 years, which I've been involved in during that time, and Dina is too, they deal with us through the State Department. It's a very different conversation that's held than the ones that are held within the United States or the United States media. So this treaty guaranteed what is now all of North Dakota, South Dakota, most of Nebraska, part of Wyoming and Minnesota as the Great Sioux Nation. Now you look at, if you look at a map, you find these non-contiguous, tiny islands in what used to be that Great Sioux Nation. So restoring that land, there are many ways to do it, and that's really the objective of Native people who have those treaties, is to restore that land. Now, a good deal of that land is in federal hands, like the Army Corps of Engineers or the National Forest Service or the National Park Service, and could simply be transferred back without hurting anyone's private property rights.
Again, if you've just joined us, we're talking to the co-authors of All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, here in studio with us, Professor Emerita of Native American Studies at Cal University East Bay, and Dina Gilio-Whitaker with us by phone, who is a journalist with Indian Country Today, Media Network, and associate scholar at the Center for World Indigenous Studies. And let's get more of your calls on. Phil, you're on.
Great show. You know, with regards to the protests at the pipeline, you know, the pipeline was proposed many years ago and was approved and had congressional overview and executive branch overview. And my question is have the First Nation established a legal protection group and lawyered up? And, you know, why did it get to the point where they're building the pipeline? Shouldn't this have been stopped when it was in approval phase?
Boy, Phil, I would recommend you listen to some of the rather heated and battle royal arguments we had on this subject on the forum program. The links are on our website. The archives will open that up for you. And I don't know if either of our guests want to weigh in here, but there's a lot to be gleaned from the shows we've done in the past. Dina, you want to say something?
Yeah. What's a pretty amazing to me, what I'm observing over the last few weeks is that, well, first of all, the media, you know, on the other side, the DAPL, the Energy Transfer Partners, has perpetuated this media this narrative that, you know, well, we tried, you know, dozens of times. I even heard one, they said, oh, 559 times we tried to communicate with Standing Rock and, you know, they ignored us and blah, blah, blah. It's a total lie. The tribe, they released, just last week, they released an audio transcript of a meeting that was held, the very initial meeting that was held with Energy Transfer Partners on September 30th of 2014. It was the first time they had ever met. Energy Transfer Partners goes into the tribal council. They do this presentation, like a 10-minute presentation. Here's our project. Just letting you know, okay, this is what's going to happen. This is not consultation. This is there are a matrix of laws that were supposed to have been followed that weren't followed. It's a complex web of just deceptions that have been perpetuated now. Laws that have been broken, lies that the Morton County Sheriff's Department tells. But this has been an egregious process from the beginning, and with Standing Rock at the losing end of this. But many, many laws have been broken, and there is a legal team on it, and they are addressing. There are more than one lawsuit, as I understand it, that is being pursued. And
No, you're right. There are a number of lawsuits. And again, I would recommend that listeners who are interested go to the links on our website. Looking at some pushback here, though, from a listener that I want to get a response to. Frank writes, I understand and sympathize with the struggles of Native Americans. However, to accuse the settlers of bringing slavery and diseases which decimated the natives is ludicrous. Slavery existed among the Native Americans long before Columbus, and yes, Columbus did enslave people. It was the 15th century, and slavery was an ugly fact within the whole world then. While the Europeans brought diseases such as smallpox, which the natives had no natural immunity to, they did not bring them on purpose.
Hmm. Yeah, that's the narrative of disappearance. I deal with that in depth in my Indigenous Peoples' History of the United States. I think there are two aspects of it here. First of all, you've got to find another term for bonded labor before the transatlantic slave trade.
There are white people who were bonded into labor, too,
well,
from Europe.
Yeah. I mean, all over the world, they're
virtually
still bonded
enslaved
labor.
Yeah.
But it shouldn't be called slavery, or else find another term
right.
for what happened after 1453 with a papal bull that gave Portugal the right to enslave all the people of West Africa. Now, that doesn't mean the people of West Africa may not have had unfair labor practices. This isn't about labor. This is about the dealing in human bodies as capital, as commodities, buying and selling. This was the main capital of the Cotton Kingdom by 1840 were human bodies that were pieces of paper to buy and sell, but they were represented human bodies. That is slavery that we're talking about. That never existed in anywhere in the world before that. It didn't exist in Europe until 1453 with that papal bull. And then it was extended to the Western Hemisphere in 1493 with another papal bull when Columbus brought slaves back. So that's one thing. The other thing is that if disease could have been the only factor, why not just wait and let everyone die? Why war against the native people from day one until 1890, unrelenting every day, war with some tribe or another? Why not just let them die of disease? That's why, that's the central fallacy of it, is that there were wars, and the entire U.S. military is based on those wars. If you go to military history, you'll find the real history of the United States.
Well, we have seconds left, but a big question that I want to bring into this, even with seconds left, what can a white person do in today's world? I don't want to appropriate the culture, invade a space that is sacred, but I want to help. What can I do? When I was in graduate school, I was told quite firmly by Native people I should not write their history for them. So what is my appropriate action? Some quick thoughts from either of you?
Yeah, I agree. You know, let Native people start telling the history, and also support their decolonization efforts. Support tribal sovereignty. Support what's happening at Standing Rock. Don't defer to the privileged colonial history.
And I thank you both, Dina Gilio-Whitaker, with us by phone, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, with us in studio. Their book again, All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our producers, Judy Campbell, Irina Gucci, and Tina Larberg. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. He had help today from Katie McMurrin, and our senior editor is Dan Zoll. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, we thank you. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.